Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are back for another episode. I think it's only fair to do some housekeeping here. If you're a member of Patreon, you already know because I put a little video up for you guys. But me, Jeff, and Dennis, we got together and we decided we're going to move to a two-show-a-month schedule. One, just because we're all super wicked busy. But two, we've been doing this since almost, 2017 now? We have gone over in-depth a lot of the stuff that we really know in-depth. And so we want to bring you guys new content. But in order to bring you new content on new topics of World War II, we got to get caught up with that. And so by moving to a two-episode-a-month schedule, it allows us more time to prep and bring you guys new content. With that being said, we're bringing you old content tonight because it's about Iwo Jima, but we'll get to that here shortly. First and foremost, before we go any further than that, you want to go ahead and get the drawing out of the way, Jeff?
I mean, or we just heighten the anticipation a little bit? Because, I mean, it's up to you. We do it now, we do it at the end. I mean, either way.
We can do it at the end of the episode. I printed up some names. They're in the old pot here. You know what, maybe to make people stick around, let's build the anticipation. Why don't you go over what the prize is going to be that we're going to give away later in the show?
One Patreon subscriber is going to a lucky Patreon subscriber is going to be sent a few items that I didn't mind donating to the show based off of the content and the subject that we're going to be talking about in this particular episode about Iwo Jima. And I totally agree. We've talked about the subject before, but I did come prepared. I think I've got some stuff to talk about that we haven't gone over. So I'm excited about that. So one of the
Not to cut you off, but we have Dennis's contribution. Last time we've done this, it was just me, right? You, and Henry. Time before that, it was just me and you. And so now we have Dennis' contribution and his ability to provide more context with the naval side.
Absolutely. So it's going to be a great show. One of the things that you're going to receive is I have it's laminated into a bookmark, and it is a genuine 3-cent stamp issued in 1945 that shows the Marines raising the flag on Mount Suribachi. It's essentially a stamp of the Joe Rosenthal photograph. It says here, the battle for the small volcanic island lasted 6 weeks. Capturing the island enabled the U.S. to build an air base within range of Japan. So I sent Don a real nice photograph of this. So it's, like I said, it's just kind of a small laminated bookmark, but it's a real stamp built into it. And
well, the nice thing about that bookmark and the size of it, it's going to prevent you from losing that stamp. So it actually, that bookmark makes it more trackable and easier to keep hold of.
You're absolutely right, because I have two other stamps, originals, that are, they're just loose. It's just the stamp. So I got to be careful. You're right. You can misplace that real easy. And then since I've been given ash and sand from Iwo Jima from so many veterans for so many years now, I decided to give a little out, put a little bit in a little plastic container here. It's about the size of a challenge coin container. So I put some volcanic ash from Iwo Jima in there. I remember the first time I got Iwo Jima sand, I was about 13 or 14, and it was like my prized possession. So I'm really excited to share some of this with another lucky winner tonight.
That is really awesome too, because, you know, Japan is really tightened down on who they're letting go out there now. So it's a rare item. It's pretty awesome. Someone's going to get that. That's very, very cool.
That's a very good point, Dennis, because we didn't really think too much about that until the last time Jared was on. And he was saying, you know, as these veterans pass away and as there's technically no reason for Japanese military to allow us to come back, they're going to start tightening it down and prevent us from coming back. And so maybe make those travel plans with your battlefield tour guides here sooner than later.
For sure.
So we decided, because of the time of year, you know, when we don't have a guest scheduled, which we do coming up, and we'll talk about that later, but when we don't have a guest, we tend to kind of lean towards anniversary of, you know, some key times in World War II, key events that were really crucial. And I think for any World War II buff, Iwo Jima does kind of hold a special place for us. Yes, it's a very popular battle. It's one of those, World War II now is almost a footnote in American history, unfortunately. But it seems like people are still familiar with the Rosenthal photograph. And it's kind of still has that enigma to it. It really captured the American public, even though the man who took it thought it really wasn't a great, photograph. But there was something so symbolic about it. And then, of course, as we know, as years have gone by, it's really become the symbol of not just victory, but just of the United States Marine Corps as a whole, right? I mean, if there's one image that captures the United States Marine, I think this is it. Of course, with the bronze statue and all the times that it's been recreated and used over the years. So Iwo has always been, especially for me, it's always been one of those battles that's really held interest for me, really held intrigue. And it's been fascinating to go beyond, okay, so we know the flag was raised, and then you learn, oh, that was actually the second flag that was raised, right? There's great movies about what happened there. And then if you go another step deeper, okay, wow, the battle actually lasted for 6 weeks. The battle goes into March. And then what I would like to reveal maybe a little later in the show is potentially something that most folks maybe have never heard of that has to do with post those 6 weeks after March of 1945 on Iwo Jima. And I'm not just talking about those the Japanese straggler that comes out years later. We've heard that story as well. So I found something that kind of fits in the timeline in between
Nice.
When the Marines were leaving the island and when that last Japanese defender surrendered. So it's in that time gap.
Real quick before we get into that, just because you brought up the Rosenthal photo, how lucky are we, especially nowadays with our lust for multimedia, how lucky it, who gets mentioned less, but hypothetically in modern days, his content gets seen more. Sergeant William Homer Bill Gnaust, the Marine combat photographer who was standing there who filmed. So not only do we have the flag raising photo, but we're lucky enough, and he caught it just in time. You missed like the first 2 seconds when they bring it off the ground. But if anytime you look at that video footage, luckily he was standing right next to Rosenthal, maybe a little bit to the left, and we were able not only to see that photo that we all love so much, but then to be able to see the actual video footage and then the has since been colored video footage. And real quick, I got a video that's going to come out coinciding with this. I've mentioned it in the past, but I was rusty on the details. I've since gone over it. So we know Rosenthal shot the photo, right? Felix de Welden saw the photo and within 24 hours started working on the project that became the 60-foot statue that we all have seen and love. Well, during that process, he built three 20-foot plaster statues. One of them went to the Marine Corps. One of them went somewhere else and was put outside and kind of melted away. And then one of them was stored away in dry storage. Well, in 1965, the Rosen brothers, the people who founded Cape Coral, reached out to de Welden. He pulled that last surviving, well, technically only two survived. One of them's, with the Marine Corps, and then this last one. That last one was actually used to build our Iwo Jima statue here in Cape Coral. And I'm releasing a video on it. So if you're ever in Southwest Florida, Jeff drove by it when he was down here at the film Walking Point. When you come over the bridge and you see that 20-foot Iwo Jima statue on the right, that is not a reproduction. That is not an homage. That is actually made from one of the three 20-foot molds that Felix de Welden himself made as part of his process. Because obviously, you're not going to go from a 1-foot statue to a 60-foot. You kind of got to figure out how you're going to expand it without losing features. And so our statue here in town is molded from one of those 20-foot statues that he made. So technically, it's one of the originals. So
Cool.
that's very
Yeah,
cool.
that is super cool. So, I mean, there you go. It's kind of it's everywhere. It's a symbol of something that's actually so much bigger than itself. And yeah, super excited that Dennis can talk about, because it's always the Marines, right? The Marines, 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 Marines hit Iwo Jima. But Dennis knows more than anybody here. The Navy's contribution specifically 3 days prior to the landing, and being able to, you know, what those LCA gunboats did, taking those hits, but setting up for success 3 days later to be able to track the muzzle flash from the hills of Suribachi so the artillery could lay a lot more accurate fire on D-Day, I think was just – it's imperative to understand that. And then a little hint to what I'm going to talk about later. So Navy, of course, Coast Guard is involved at times with especially with LCVPs and landing guys on the beach. The Marines take the island. But how many of you know how much the Army fought on Iwo Jima? Dennis is shaking his head. Yes, because yeah. This guy's a wizard, right? Like he knows. He knows Iwo. But I'm betting a lot of our listeners don't know this story, and I'm real excited to talk about it.
Absolutely. Awesome. And we've brought this up before. You know, anything from the miniseries to the books to just the topic at large. When you think the Pacific or the Pacific Theater Operations, you just assume the Navy and the Marine Corps. And yeah, the Army was there, you know, to drop off some gear that we stole and all that fun stuff. So no, I too am very interested to hear about the Army's contribution to this battle.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear that.
Carrying a firearm daily comes with serious responsibilities. Responsibilities your everyday counterparts may not have to consider. Knowing where you can and cannot legally bring your firearm is crucial. But sometimes, life takes you places where carrying isn't an option. That's where the StopBox Pro portable gun safe comes in. Securely store your firearm in your vehicle while handling life's obligations. Safety, responsibility, and with peace of mind. StopBox Pro. Protection when you need it, security when you don't. For more information, visit StopBoxUSA.com/D410.
On February 3rd, 1945, General Kobayashi, the commander of Iwo Jima, wrote his family the last letter that he got out. He's writing to his wife. As I always say, there's a good chance that the enemy air raids will multiply in intensities to many times their present levels from spring onwards. So I think you should quickly go somewhere safe while you are still able to do so. It's unlikely you'll be killed by a bomb proper, but you must understand there is a considerable danger of being killed by the fire caused by an incendiary. They have started dropping large numbers of incendiaries where I am, and fires occur, although there is nothing to burn here. And of course, that portends what would be the great fires that would envelop. And Kobayashi saw that. He could see the writing on the wall. He knew he was going to die. He knew all of his men were going to die. He knew Iwo Jima was going to be made into an airfield. And he was warning his wife to get out.
This small island in the Pacific, only 8 square miles in size, became the setting for one of the bloodiest fights in the history of the United States Marine Corps, a fight that would test the limits of human endurance, courage, and sacrifice. Iwo Jima, a name that before 1945 meant little to the world, just a speck in the vast Pacific, roughly 5 miles long and 2.5 miles wide at the broadest point. But what made this island so crucial was its location, a strategic stepping stone between the United States-held Marianas and the Japanese mainland. Capturing it meant securing a foothold.
Iwo Jima's drama really started on the 16th of February, and it started with the minesweeping operations. It was a little hint of how tenacious the Japanese were going to be when one of the minesweepers gets hit, when they're just doing their regular boring sweeps off the shores of Iwo Jima. Operations that they've done many times before at many other islands, Saipan, Guam, Tinian, other places, and there had been no problems. But suddenly at Iwo Jima, one of the minesweepers gets hit, and it's a little hint of what's about to happen. Meanwhile, 12 LCI gunboats from LCI Flotilla 3 are on their way. And I wrote something this morning that I would want to read to kind of start this off. Cooks and seamen aboard the darkened, bobbing gunboats had been up for hours, whipping up great batches of eggs. The glorious aroma of freshly baked bread and pies carried on invisible wings throughout the ships, bringing smiles to the faces of the fitfully sleeping sailors. The crew's frantic pace, combined with the massive amount of food prep, bespoke of great events on the horizon. The sailors could smell it before they could see it, the island, that is, and it was only days before that they'd come to know its real name. During rehearsals and briefings at Ulithi, they had only known it as Island X, the destination now off to the northeast, still hours away, vented an oppressive aroma of rotten eggs that made its way through ventilation shafts and blacked-out hatches. The disgusting and mysterious scent spoke volumes of the island that would soon test every fiber of their being. To the Japanese, it was known as Iwo Jima, Sulfur Island, and workmen on the island at that moment could little fathom the titanic forces then descending from all parts of the compass to their location. Of course, Japanese knew an invasion was coming, and they had been feverishly working in abysmal conditions to turn the island into a fortress. Their commander, who had traveled to America and actually had American friends, knew the way to hurt the Americans was not to meet them on the beach, as had been done so many other battles, but to let the U.S. get ashore, bunch up, and then blast them into oblivion. The idea was to make the Americans pay in blood for every square inch of the godforsaken island.
Iwo Jima was a fortress covered in unforgiving terrain. Its sands, made from thick volcanic ash, swallowed boots and made movements grueling and challenging. And looming above it all in the distance was the ominous peak of Mount Suribachi, 556 feet of hard rock, a natural stronghold at the island's southern tip.
For the gunboat sailors, their mission was one they had performed multiple times at places like Saipan, Guam, Tinian. The majority of the crews of the battle-hardened flat-bottomed ships were well-tested, having seen combat as far back as the Aleutians and Kwajalein, Inuitok, Alingalapalap, Uteric, and dozens of other atolls in the Marshalls. So this flotilla, LCI Flotilla 3, was the most battle-hardened of the Navy. And they were at this moment mere hours away from Iwo Jima. Their mission? To provide cover for the recon portion of the invasion 2 days off, 2 days before the Marines arrived on the 19th. The recon element made up of UDT 12, 13, 14, and 15, over 100 frogmen, would swim in ice-cold water with only a thin layer of grease spread over their bodies. And then offshore, they'd drop into this frozen water, swim toward the beach. The gunboats lined up across from their assigned colored beaches, and in a matter of an hour, would make naval history.
The Battle of Iwo Jima was unlike anything the United States military had encountered before. The Japanese knew they couldn't win a direct confrontation against the overwhelming might of the United States forces, so they prepared something else, a battle of attrition, a fight to the last man. Kobayashi transformed the island into a near-impregnable labyrinth of defenses. Over 11 miles of tunnels snaked beneath the island, linking command posts, barracks, and supply caches. Pillboxes and hidden artillery bunkers were strategically placed, offering interlocking fields of fire. More than 1,500 reinforced fighting positions covered the landscape, allowing the Japanese defenders, estimated to be between 21,000 and 22,000 strong, to hold out against the inevitable onslaught.
That history started, for most of the gunboats, at about 10:50. On the morning of the 17th. As they cruised in towards their assigned beaches, a mission they had done many times before, they'd taken casualties, but it was only one gunboat hit here and an occasional one hit a couple weeks later. So they weren't unprepared mentally for what was about to happen. About 10:55, LCI 441 on the extreme right flank of Iwo Jima's beaches took the first hit, a massive hit, a mortar, right on the bow, causing explosion, throwing bodies across the deck. William Hildebrand of the LCI 449 was 500 yards to the port of the 441. And he could see it. He just about yelled back, "The 441 got," when they got hit. They got hit by a mortar on the ammunition locker on the 449. Now see, the difference between what was happening to the gunboats on the right flank and the left flank was significant. On the left flank, the LCIs 473, 471, 474, 473, 471, 450, 438, they were all near off Mount Suribachi, and they were all taking artillery hits. Why is that important? Because artillery from that close and that trajectory was a straight shot. It was like a rifle shot, a big rifle. But what they did to the 473 was, these gunners, someone had such an excellent shot from Suribachi if the artillery actually punched through the big 4-7-3 painted in bright white numbers on the side of the ship, nice for zeroing in on, punched right through that, and then the gunner followed it up, and it's even in the battle report from the 473. This excellent gunner followed that shot with one through the hole, and it went into the engines, knocking all the engines out and flooding the engine room with 8 feet of water. It just so happened the 473 was turning at that moment, and its momentum allowed it to coast further out from shore. And they noted they hit, they had about 40 large artillery splashes, 100 yards, that kept falling about 100 yards short. So they were just out of range, thankfully. But they were all hit. Every single one of them were hit. The relief vessels went in to help them. They were hit. The LCI sailors, though, they, on that flank, on the left flank, they were being hit by these artillery shells. And so it was kind of a blessing, because where was all the crew? They weren't down below. They were up top. So the shells that were hitting, they were hitting in the flanks and the sides of the ship and the hide of the ship. And they were blowing up in empty troop compartments. They were blowing up in empty galleys. They were blowing up, and of course, in the engine room, which was knocking out some of the propulsion. But there wasn't massive casualties on the LCIs on the left flank. On the right flank, it was a different story. Because on there, the LCIs were being hit by mortars. And they were the large mortars. And they were floating in and landing among the crew. And that's why you would see the 449 would have 21 killed and 22 wounded out of the crew of 70. The 441 would have just as many casualties. The 438 would be significantly damaged and bloodied. And from the guys, the stories that were told, a lot of their ability to communicate with the help was wiped out as masts were blown off the ship, taking with them the signal flags, taking with them the radio antennas. Then they had signal lights, but those had all been smashed from explosions in the 449. And then when just recently, yesterday, I was going through my garage looking for material about this, and I came across an interview I forgot I did about with the signalman from the USS Tennessee, the battleship that was covering them. George Panos was his name. He described how frustrated he was as a signalman, because that day the wind was low, and those flags that did have pennants, they just draped down and covering each other. It was an interesting little detail that I had no idea about. The flags, they couldn't even signal that they were injured or they needed assistance because the flags were draped down. But the one thing about this was that UDT guys, their commander, Red Ball Hanlon, he said that what he heard that day on the radio aboard the Estes, the command ship, what he heard that day should go down in naval history along with, this was his quote, not mine, with "damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead," or "I have not yet begun to fight." He heard radio traffic from the LCIs that day, and what he heard said it moved him to tears, and it made him say that he wished it would go into naval history. And what it was is it was a radio message that came from the LCI 469. And the radio message was, "Fires under control. Request permission to return to the line." It wasn't "fires extinguished." It wasn't "repairs all conducted, ready to go back in." It was "fires under control. Request permission to get to the line." And that kind of dedication really spoke of the leadership of LCI Flotilla 3 under Commander Mad Mike Malanafy and his men under him. They had a mission: protect the frogmen. They only lost one in the water that day. Over 100 frogmen in the water, they lost one. On my grandpa's ship, they lost in UDT 14's commander, executive officer, Lieutenant Byron Yarbrough, but he was aboard the ship there. So what were the benefits of it? You would think all this death, all this loss, 54 guys died total, over 200 were wounded in action, and from all the different gunboats combined, a group of about 700 men. What was the benefit of it? The benefit of it was that aboard all these destroyers, the Lutz, the Hall, the Twigs, the Black, aboard the battleships, the Nevada, the Texas, the Tennessee, were little beady-eyed sailors who all had, with their binoculars and their long glasses, were watching. And everywhere they would see a door open and an artillery piece come out, they would jot it down. They would see a flash, and they would see a puff, and they would jot it down. And this information was quickly relayed and jotted down in charts all over the bay that day. And Admiral Groskopf, breaking orders, took the Nevada in point blank range, which is something, man, if I had a time capsule and I could go back in time, took that point blank range. And an eyewitness actually reported seeing artillery pieces tumbling down Mount Suribachi that day. Pieces of gunners that were so accurate they could punch a hole in the side of a ship and follow it up with another artillery shell through the same hole. Artillery pieces that now, because of the sacrifice made by the LCI sailors, were not available to the Japanese on the invasion day 2 days later. All of that. And then on the 19th, when the Marines came, they had no idea that as they were coasting into the beach, how much had already been done. How that as they cruised in towards and lumbered along those LVTs, as they lumbered along towards Iwo, they were crossing over the bodies of 54 sailors who had been buried at sea. And all that loss and all that sacrifice just to try to give them a chance at success.
But before American boots would ever touch the sands of Iwo Jima, the island was pounded by a relentless air and naval bombardment. The U.S. launched 74 pre-landing bombing missions, sending in waves of B-24s and B-29 bombers from the Marianas. At first, the raids were relatively small, 12 to 24 aircraft per mission. But as the invasion date neared, the strikes intensified. By the final days, up to 100 bombers would rain fire and destruction down on the island in a single mission. And then the Navy took its turn. From February 16th to February 19th, the United States fleet opened fire. Battleships, cruisers, and destroyers unleashed everything they had, pounding the island in an attempt to weaken its defenses. But Kobayashi's strategy had been masterful. His men remained concealed deep in their bunkers, waiting for the inevitable landing invasion. More than 450 landing craft carried the men of the 3rd, 4th, and 5th Marine Divisions, nearly 70,000 Marines, toward the shores of Iwo Jima. Supporting them, the U.S. Navy provided nearly 40,000 personnel for amphibious and bombardment operations, while the Army Air Forces controlled the sky. The ramps dropped, the world turned to hell. The smell of diesel, salt, and something else, something burnt, clung in the air. My boots sank into the black volcanic sand as I leapt off the Higgins boat. My rifle clutched, hands shaking, hearts pounding. The plan was to rush forward, push inland, secure the beachhead. But nothing went to plan. The sand was deep, sucking at our feet, slowing us down, making us perfect targets. The moment we hit the beach, the Japanese let loose. Machine guns cracked from hidden bunkers, and the mortars came screaming in. Men were dropping left and right, so never even made it off the boats. I dove forward, hugging the earth, feeling the grit against my teeth. I could hear the screams, the shouts of Corman, but I couldn't look back. Somehow, we crawled forward inch by inch, through the blood and fire, the bodies of our own laid scattered on the surf, the waves washing over them, as if trying to pull them back home. But there was no going back. The island had to be taken, no matter the cost. I don't know how long we were pinned down before we moved. Minutes, hours. Time didn't exist, just survival. My rifle felt like part of my body, my fingers locked around it, and all I could do was keep pushing forward, through the smoke, through the sands, through the worst of it, because that's what Marines do. The Marine divisions and their objectives, just to lay out the outline of this. The 4th Marine Division was on the right flank, the southeast beaches. Their landing beaches were beaches Yellow 1 and Yellow 2. Their objectives were to secure the eastern side of the island and advance towards the heavily fortified airfield number 1. Some of the challenges they faced were fierce resistance from Japanese pillboxes, bunkers, hidden machine gun nests. We had the 5th Marine Division there on the left flank, southwest beaches of Mount Suribachi. Landing beaches were Green 1 and Green 2. Their objective was essentially to capture the volcanic Mount Suribachi and cut off the southern portion of the island. Their challenges were the Japanese defenders used vast networks of tunnels and caves, forcing the Marines into brutal close-quarter combat. The 28th Marines, part of the 5th Division, raised the famous flag on Mount Suribachi on February 23rd. Then you had the 3rd Marine Division. Landing beaches were Blue 1 and Blue 2. Initially, they were held in reserve. Objectives: once committed, they were tasked with pushing north and taking airfield number 2 and advancing towards the heavily fortified Japanese stronghold in the north. Challenges: faced intense resistance at places like Hill 362, otherwise known as the Meat Grinder, and the final Japanese defensive line at Kyoto Point. As the Marines stormed the beaches, they expected a brutal resistance, the kind they had previously experienced during the island-hopping campaign of the Pacific. But surprisingly, the beaches were eerily quiet. Unbeknownst to them, they were stepping into a trap. Kobayashi had ordered his forces to hold fire until the beaches were packed with American troops and equipment. And when they finally opened up, all hell broke loose.
Can't imagine trying to run through that.
Through that sand?
I can't imagine trying to, you know, at least in some battles in Europe, you get to run from street corner to street corner, or hide behind a hedge, or hide behind some tree, or run from some shattered building to another. Or if you're in Bastogne, you can dig a hole and hopefully, if it's not too cold, and the hole you're digging isn't going to immediately start collapsing in on you because of the way that the substance that you're digging in is so fine. It just immediately starts to fill in. And then you've got the hell of the vents, the heat vents coming up, which turned out to be a mixed blessing and a curse, right? Because it was so cold that the heat kind of helped him at night. But it's just, you know, looking at it, I, of course, had never seen combat. Jeff has. He can speak to this more educatedly than any of us can. But, you know, I can definitely empathize and, you know, just I can't imagine not being able to run very fast because of the ground is just, it's like you're sandbags on your feet and you're trying to run and there's no cover. That kind of courage.
And to that point, as you're saying that, you know, the closest thing that I could even think of that are most of our audience who've never experienced combat, it's almost like that dream. You ever had that dream where like you get in a fight and no matter how hard you swing, you can't make contact with the person you're fighting? That almost had to be like, they're trying to run to find safety and their feet just aren't moving no matter how hard they try. And this kind of goes back to downside of what the technology was at the time, because reading up on this today, we all know, for example, when the Rangers landed at Pointe du Hoc, they knew the elevation and they had trained with the, you know, the ladder systems and the grappling hook rope ladders and all these different ways. Well, when our intelligence was kind of laying out the landings at Iwo Jima, the photographs, because of the quality of the photograph back in the day, they had no idea of the 15-foot sandy embankments that they were going to have to climb. They just thought it was a gentle roll. They thought, we're going to land them on the beach, be a little sandy, but they can make their way up. They had no idea of the 15-foot tall sandy berms. That's why we didn't come equipped with any sort of ladder systems or planking systems, any way to get up over a 15-foot sandy berm. That's why our guys were stuck sinking into it, because we had no idea that they were there prior to the landing waves, because they just didn't show up on the black and white, you know, high altitude photographs. The machine guns, mortars, and artillery erupted from hidden positions, cutting through the Marines. The volcanic sands offered no cover. The American forces were pinned down, struggling to advance against the determined enemy that refused to surrender. This was the beginning of one of the bloodiest battles in World War II, a battle that would last 5 weeks. A battle that would test the courage, endurance, and sacrifice of every man.
Jeff, didn't they show up with jeeps on some of the Higgins boats? They just immediately just were inert.
Yeah, just this conversation, it reminds me of a conversation I had with old Fred Harvey, a dear friend that I really miss. Mm. And you know, for Fred, Iwo was the 4th island campaign that he participated in, and he lasted 9 days before it took several Japanese grenades to evacuate him off the island. But he said every fly boy that dropped a bomb on Iwo Jima needs to get a medal. Mm-hmm. He said, because those bombs may not have done a lot of damage, to the emplacements. He said, but instantaneously they could dig a foxhole
Oh,
for
wow.
all of us that hit the beach. And you know, we don't think about that. We really don't. Every one of those holes that you see in the actual footage or in pictures, that's courtesy of the 7th Air Force B-24s that have been hitting it for almost 7 months.
Wow.
And you bring up another good point too, Don, about photo reconnaissance. You know, the battle started unfolding as early as July of 44, you know, when the 7th started going in. And Kobayashi, that shows up in some of his letters home, as early as July of 1944, the air raids started happening. And that's when they really kind of got the idea that, okay, Iwo is a target. The civilian population had to start being either conscripted for labor or, of course, sent back to the mainland, those that you could get to be sent back. But at that time, the Japanese had to consider too that only 150 or so miles away to the north lie Chichijima, which had a navigable harbor, had runways. So it's interesting to think Iwo had no harbor. And Kobayashi didn't take much Japanese intelligence to figure out exactly where the Marines were going to land, because it was the only place that they could land. By the end of July, the Japanese defenders in the air were completely knocked out. I think there was initially about 80 aircraft that they had at their disposal for combat air patrols. And within three or four air raids from the Hellcats, they were completely, almost completely annihilated, down to, I think, the last five. It was a handful of, there's a couple zeros and then a couple Judys, I think. And then they were taken out on the runway by B-24s bombing. So once that air cover was completely annihilated, we kind of had our way from a photo reconnaissance standpoint. And yeah, you're right. I don't, the photos were crystal clear, taken at low altitude. I mean, it's like the best conditions you could think of for intelligence purposes. But yeah, that the quality, or maybe the lack thereof, of that volcanic ash. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you see the wreckage on the beach, and it's not just because of accurate gunfire from the Japanese. Of course, give the gunners credit up in Suribachi, but they just couldn't go anywhere. Yeah, I mean, like Don said, these quarter tons roll off LCVPs, or ducks are coming in, or you know, trying to put tanks ashore, and they just simply sunk. And yeah, I look. Yeah, I get combat's combat and all, but no, I don't have any idea what that would be like either. You know, for guys who have done a tactical living history event, you've got this gear on, and if you're not accustomed to just running in general, it's a clumsy ordeal. And that just had to have been compounded by that, by the quality, like I said, of just that soft mush. I love the line, and both of you probably will remember. I love the line from Sands of Iwo Jima, where, and I can't think of the character's name, but he was a farmer from Tennessee, and he gets pinged, and he's laying there on Iwo Jima, and he's looking at the soil. He said, "This must be the poorest soil." He said, "God must have taken everything that was left over when he made the earth and put it here, you know, getting shot for this," you know, as a farm boy from Tennessee, like you, it's just junk. But I want to ask that, I want to throw this at you guys, because right around the same time that the air raid started happening in July of 44, something came across FDR's desk. And he did not give approval for this. This was denied. But it brings out, I think, an interesting conversation. Did you know that there was initially a plan to have Navy gunners gas Iwo Jima?
Jeez.
Now, the gunners were not going to be told that that's what was happening. They were going to put high explosive shells mixed in. So the shells that were gas would either look like a dud, or they would hit and it was extra smoke. They wouldn't realize it, right? It's like the one guy in the firing squad with a blank, you know, round. So interesting to think about it. And FDR, obviously, FDR denies this mission. And I think he probably, maybe, I'd like to think, maybe he had the forethought to, what would that have looked like post-war, right? We gassed the island. We let it naturally detox. We send Marines ashore, and we basically capture dead, dying, incapacitated Japanese garrison. Now, granted, probably still the ones that were dug in wouldn't be as affected. Still going to be a fight. But to just completely launch a bunch of gas shells over a 10-square-mile island and then to come away victorious from that, there would have been some heads rolling, I think, post-war.
Oh, and it would have been at the top of every conversation, because that would have been the only time during the entire war that we deployed gas on any battlefield, especially that magnitude. So, yeah, that would have been a huge topic of conversation. And it probably would have shined us in a little bit of a different light amongst our allies throughout the world.
It's like if the one target you could –